For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
So as many of you know, this week is Sangha Week at Green Gulch Farm. So a lot of the smiling faces that you normally see in the room and online are there enjoying the practice at Green Gulch Farm or Green Dragon Temple, one of the three main temples in our lineage, which is the Shunryu Suzuki lineage of Soto Zen. So I have been recruited, since I am in Chicago, I have been recruited to give the talk today. So oftentimes I might be looking at something that is informing my practice, or there might be some events happening that inform my practice as well. But if there's nothing directly in front of me, I have been going to this book called Transmission of the Light, which is 53 Enlightenment stories that were originally compiled by the fourth generation head of the Soto Zen lineage in Japan. His name was Keizan. Along with Dogen, Keizan is a very important figure in Japanese Soto Zen because he helped Soto Zen to really flourish in Japan. And he also made it very accessible to lay people. In the course of him heading the lineage, it's believed that he wrote down these transmission stories around, he lived between the late 1200s, early 1300s in Japan, and he wrote or compiled these stories around 1300 CE. And there's a lot of debate about whether that's true or not and the authorship of all of it, but I'm going to go with the simple version. So the story that I'm on in this process is the fourth story. And mind you, these stories are essentially, we call them enlightenment stories, but they're very much about a teacher and an interaction with their disciples or a disciple. And oftentimes, it's a story too of how a person decides to accept a teacher and become a disciple. And of course, all of them also give us a little snippet that we can work with in our own practice to this day. So I'm going to jump right into the short story of Shanabasa. Shanabasa's teacher was Ananda. So I could tell you this simply too, because I'm not that far into the book. So there's Shakyamuni Buddha, then Kashyapa, then Ananda, and here we are on Shanabasa as far as the lineage goes. Shanabasa asked Ananda, "What is the fundamental, uncreated essence of all things?" Ananda pointed to the corner of Shanabasa's vest. Shanabasa asked, "What is the basic essence of the enlightenment of the Buddhas?" Ananda grabbed the corner of Shanabasa's vest and tugged on it. Shanabasa was then enlightened. So as you can see, these are very complicated stories. And I'm joking because it's only a few lines, but there's so much there. So I'd like to look at maybe what some of this is speaking about. Realizing the fundamental uncreated essence of all things, or what is the fundamental uncreated essence of all things? So there's commentary that Keizan wrote around the lines of this story. And according to this story, Shanabasa was the first person ever to ask this question. And I don't know why I felt that was very important to bring up, but it really felt like that was very important to bring that up. So I want to just throw that out there before we unpack this a little bit. So what is the underlying essence and what is the uncreated underlying essence? In Buddhist teachings, there is a concept of universal truth. And we know the word dharma oftentimes, well, dharma does mean truth or teachings, or the truth of the teachings. So we often say there is an underlying universal truth to our existence. And that underlying universal truth, now here comes the paradox, is rooted in emptiness. And then out of that emptiness, things become created. And then when things become created, the sentient beings, or the beings in that creation, are then operating in what's called particular truth or conventional truth. And we know it is our everyday truth. So we're all operating in that right now. We're sitting in a room. You guys are at home online. You're using a computer. I could touch the carpet on the floor. I'm looking now at Dylan. There's an altar. Everything here is a particular truth because it arose. It has been created. And there's a format or structure around it. So the question is, that universal truth that doesn't have any of this, what is the essence of that? So in other words, before things actually happen, that universal truth is just empty. But if it's empty, how could it have any essence? So maybe this is kind of what Shanavasa was thinking about. First person to ever think about it. So though in Buddhist teachings, we're taught that things are empty, there is a type of, let's see, now when I pick a word to say there is a type of, I'm already creating a particular truth. Because the minute I put a word around what that might be, there's a structure to it. No matter how abstract that word might be. But because we are in a particular conventional truth right now, I'm going to pick the word vibration. So though things are empty, the idea might be that there is an underlying vibration. And that underlying vibration has not been produced by anything or anyone at all. So this is very different in comparison to other religious or possibly philosophical beliefs. In Buddhism, there is no one creation story where there's an entity or a being or a primary idea that has created everything that we are now existing in. So what is that? What is that? So when Shanavasa asked this question, Ananda pointed to the corner of the vest. We'll get back to the pointing in a minute. But let's talk about the vest. And again, there's a lot of information around these stories that Kazan provided us to provide more clarity to the story. In Sanskrit, the vest is called kashaya. And what that means, translated into English, is indefinite color or unborn color. So although the vest exists, it doesn't really have any defined personality yet. Like our Buddha nature. So here's another concept that we're taught if we practice Buddhism, that we all have Buddha nature. We have some kind of underlying essence that is already enlightened, but yet we don't realize it. Because we're living with a lot of distractions, that's uncovering it up. And actually, if we could unveil those distractions or open them up, we'll realize that there's an underlying Buddha nature to all of us, that when we have the idea of becoming enlightened, it's already there. And everything in our existence has this underlying realization. And whether we believe it or not, whether we believe things do have them or not, it's Buddhist teachings tell us it's there. It doesn't require a belief. So if it doesn't require a belief, though, how do we know it exists if there's no actual definition for it? So you could see how a lot of these teachings are paradoxical. But I'm giving a side note. I think it's that way so that we could open up our thinking. We could open up our field of experience and break down the structure of the way we normally see things. Because it could be difficult to immerse yourself in some of these texts. These stories are easier. That's why I look at them. A lot of Dogen's writings, is he's the master at it. And that's why he's so important. But anyway, how do we know this underlying nature, or maybe Buddha nature, or essence exists if there's no definition, if it's uncreated? Where our practice tells us that we know this by sitting in zazen. So if we sit in zazen, we have a chance of experiencing it. We're sitting in stillness, so we could experience it before it becomes delineated or discriminated or structurally created. And it's important, according to our Zen masters, that we experience it, that we don't necessarily look at stories all the time, because the stories encourage us to practice, but not get so lost in the story that we don't experience the essence for ourselves through zazen practice. So if we do experience this underlying essence, is that then a taste of enlightenment? I won't have as much hubris to say, are we then enlightened? But I'll say, do we have a little taste of it? So Shanavasa asked, what's the basic essence of the enlightenment of the Buddhas? And that's when Ananda tugged on Shanavasa's vest. Why? To let him know that the Buddhas come out in response to the search for them. So they're there all the time, and even now they're around us all the time. But they don't appear until we ask for them. We look for them. We inquire of them. So in our practice, we talk about response, oftentimes. In our way of talking about it, we talk about skillful response. And we often talk about compassionate response. And usually when we do talk about response, it's with the idea that we are fully present in the moment. Something happens. We didn't have any idea about things happening, ideally, if we have a really good practice. But as humans, of course, we have expectations all the time. But we're fully present in the moment. Something happens. A skillful response is that we're reacting in a way that makes sense for what actually happened in front of us without us anticipating how we should react to it. And that response, according to our teachings, is rooted in wisdom. When we talk about compassionate response, it's the same thing in the sense that we're fully present in the moment. Something happens that might require us to have a soft heart, an openness, a kindness in our response. But how do we know what that might be? According to the teachings, it's rooted in wisdom. So how does that wisdom develop? Through zazen practice. We can't coordinate it. It's something that ruminates over time. It's something that happens for each person on a different timeline, comes and goes, nothing's linear. But our Zen masters give us the encouragement that if we practice zazen, we could touch this underlying uncreated essence And then we could also realize the essence of the enlightenment of the Buddhas. These things will happen because we practice. So there's a lot of different ways our practices support that idea. Because, as these stories tell us, nothing happens in a vacuum. So technically, if you hold yourself up in a cave, you might have Sartori experiences, you might have some enlightenment experiences, but you won't fully realize the enlightenment of the Buddhas. Because our Zen masters tell us that the full realization happens in relationship to other beings and the environment that we're experiencing. So we have this structure of teacher and student, and we play a role in that all the time, whether we formally have a teacher or whether we formally think of ourselves as a student. Just by walking through the door at Ancient Dragon, which every single one of us has done at some point, everyone in this room, everyone online, we were searching, maybe not specifically for the Buddha, but we were searching for answers around enlightenment or realizing the truth of our reality. So we played the role in being the asker, of having an aspiration. And if you have been at Ancient Dragon, and when I'm saying Ancient Dragon, but I mean in the structure of practice that we have, it doesn't have to be this monastery or this group or this sitting group, it could be anyone. But if you've been there longer than a week, and I mean 7 days, not just one Sunday, but if you were there longer than a week, at some point you answered some question of someone who just walked through the door. And it might be as simple as, how do I bow again? So in that interaction, you're responding to an ask, and you're a teacher in that moment. So we think of it as something that's asked and something that's answered. But in the commentary around this kind of relationship, Keizan's exact words are, although there has never been anything to give to anyone or anything to receive from anyone, it is necessary to experience this as intimately as feeling the nose on your face. So in this sentence, he again points to emptiness. But as he's pointing to emptiness, he's also pointing to the relationship, because there is no intimacy without the relationship, even though the relationship is actually rooted in emptiness. Do you see what I mean about paradoxal? It just blows your mind. So I'm going to read that quote again. Although there has never been anything to give to anyone or anything to receive from anyone, it is necessary to experience this as intimately as feeling the nose on your face. So we have a practice that firmly roots us in this interaction of emptiness by the structure that was created around it. And with practice here, we can then hopefully take that out into the world if we're aware of our practice. We could take that out into the world if we're present in what's going on around us, as we are dealing with our particular truths, our conventional truths, which we all know is easier said than done. In this interaction, Keizan tells us that Buddhas have appeared one after another, after another, after another. And in this interaction, Zen teachers are there generation after generation after generation after generation. So I wanted to just roll back a little bit to Ananda pointing to Shanavasa's vest, because he didn't touch it, he just pointed at it. For me, just in general, with my own practice, I think about intention a lot, because we're often instructed not to goal set in Buddhist practice, because when you goal set, you have a concrete idea of what the end result should be. But we all know that we do things for reasons. Otherwise, we'd never get out of bed in the morning. And Buddhist teachings tell us a lot about intention, loving kindness, compassion. What's your intention as you move forward in your life? So when I looked at this line of him pointing at something, to me, that's his intention to create something. But I wanted to bring it up because in Zen teachings, pointing with a finger is analogous to the teachings in general. That the teachings are there as a pointing vehicle, but you should not focus on the finger. You should focus on what's being pointed at. So I felt that might be an important aspect to bring up in relation to the story. But other than that, I just wanted to read a little bit more from the text, and then I'll open it up for discussion. And I wanted to read a little bit more because here's the other thing about these teaching stories. For me personally, I'm always so touched. And even though these stories were compiled over 1,000 years ago about people who lived more than 3,000 years ago and some longer, but yet they are so compassionate to us living in this day and age about not getting discouraged in our practice. And it's really amazing to me, you know, talk about wisdom and enlightenment. You know, we all feel this way. The world's changing and people have different priorities and this, that, and every other thing. And you think that a lot of what's important to you isn't going to be important to people, not even 100 years from now, right? And here are people who anticipated that it would be, well, maybe they didn't, but, well, maybe they did if they're enlightened, you know, that these things would be important over 1,000 years from now, that human beings are human beings, and there are certain fundamental truths to our human existence. All right, here's Kazan's words, translated by Thomas Clearly. Zen study demands that you investigate and awaken on your own. It should be clear from the story of Shanavasa that you should not waste your life. You should not just be a spontaneous naturalist, and you should not prefer your idea of yourself or your former views. You may think that Buddhist Zen is just for special people and that you are not fit for it, but such ideas are the worst kind of folly. Isn't that nice? Who among the ancients was not immortal? That I love the most.
Is not immortal.
And not a mortal. Is immortal. Not a mortal. I love that the most. It points to the fact that all the Buddhas at some point had a mortal existence. They lived and died. So who among the ancients was not immortal? Whose personality was not influenced by social and material values? Oh yeah. Once they studied Zen, however, they penetrated all the way through. Therefore, do not regret that you were not born in the land of the Buddha's birthplace, and do not lament that you have not been met by the Buddha living in the world. Well, maybe we have. We just don't know it. In the past, all of us, so he's saying, in the past, you planted seeds of virtue and formed affinity with wisdom. So we already have a seed of wisdom in all of us. And it is because of this, Kazan says, that all of us have gathered here in the Sangha. So I'll close with that and see what this might have possibly brought up for all of you. Thank you very much, everybody. Really, I really enjoyed looking at the story. It's a lot there. Hi, Paul.
Hi. How do you understand the statement, if I'm remembering it correctly, that one should not be a spontaneous naturalist? What do you,
I see that more as hedonistic in the sense that I am who I am, and this life is about physical sensations and having a good time, and you know, I'm just going to go with the flow as far as my sensations tell me to go. That's how I interpreted that. What about you?
I don't know. I was struck by it. I'm not sure.
Maybe it's you know, naturalist, and so my mind goes to like nudist colonies right away. Because I was born in the early 60s, and those were popular through the 70s, where people would just go and live without clothes on, you know. And it was actually more sensual time throughout the 60s and 70s, where people were very hedonistic and wanted to experience life that way. So I think that's why my mind went that way, my conditioning of, you know. What does anybody else think about spontaneous naturalist?
Well, maybe just, you know, I mean, that really caught me as well, because I automatically, like, went to all of my friends that are naturalists, but I think in a different sense. And, you know, and I don't think any of those people other than, you know, a few people around the temple are new this or anything like that. But, you know, I think it's just this idea, maybe, that you don't have to practice. I mean, what we see is what we get, and therefore our moment-to-moment activities can be guided appropriately simply on the basis of what we want and we don't want. You know, so maybe it's that kind of idea, and sort of as contrasted to, as talk, asking yourself questions and looking more deeply and practicing something like that.
Thank you, Neil-san.
I think the word spontaneous is the one that sticks out to me, that maybe that's a encouragement for vows of some kind or some sort, or precepts of some kind, that part of the journey of being sincere about figuring out meaning or searching for meaning, it involves a settling on certain precepts as being values that you are settled in, and maybe that's the spontaneous part is that's the pivotal point of that it's. As you said, like the going with the flow and just, you know, wherever I am, whatever I'm doing, there's no consequences necessarily, or there's no, you know, it's all just vibing all the time, and, you know, it feels good now, then fine, and we'll see, you know, later on, and that the spiritual journey, whatever, you know, the tent you fall into is about finding those sets of values and practicing them and being in relationship with other people about investigating them.
That makes a lot of sense to me too.
Yeah.
Because the precepts require us to learn how to pause before we respond and not just respond knee-jerk. You know, especially realistically with our speech, you know, to take a little beat before something comes out of our mouths, because usually that's the most spontaneous way we respond to things. But yeah, I could see that completely. Thank you, Dylan. Mm-hmm. Does this bring up this teaching bring up anything else for anybody? Those of you online?
Kirsten has her hand up.
Hi, Kirsten.
Hi, thank you for that talk. That was wonderful. And it really resonates with some of the stuff that has been coming up for me during practice. And I'm happy to sort of follow Dylan a little bit in his engagement with the precepts, because I've noticed what struck me about your talk actually was this distinction between goals versus intentions. And that keeps coming up for me a little bit as I prepare for Jukai, I've found myself in recent weeks almost giving myself like an assignment for a week with regards to the precepts. And I know that's not exactly the intention, but I'll say, okay, today or this week, I'm going to think about, you know, patience and just sort of think about it and sit with patience and just take one of the precepts and sort of sit with it until it sort of blows over. And sometimes I've been doubting myself because I know they interact and they're sort of our own spiritual container as well as our engagement with one another and our engagement with the Dharma. But I feel as if recently I've been isolating them slightly just to try to focus on one at a time. And I recognize even with sitting that that's sort of too narrow. It's so stilted. So I wonder, how do you sort of pivot, make sure one pivots in practice towards intention rather than setting a goal or for me, like a homework assignment, you know, in terms of trying to understand each precept?
So there's a few things there. But I don't think there's anything wrong with focusing on an idea like patience and trying to keep that in the forefront. Because through that focusing, like you said, you're learning about the other precepts, right? Because you're trying to focus on only one for a week, let's say, and the other ones kind of start rearing their heads at the same time. And I think for Westerners, we think so linearly. But in that process of focusing on one, you're learning that it's circular. None of them operate by themselves. And they all inform and require the practice of each other in a circular fashion. Number one. Number two, part of our practice also is impermanence in realizing that we have to adjust quite often in our lives. So when you have a focus on something and then you're finding within that focus, you're becoming rigid, it's actually giving you an opportunity to practice impermanence and zigging when you should be zagging or zagging when you should zig. So I think in practice and practicing with precepts, there is no wrong way of doing it, because whatever you decide to do that seems to make sense for you is going to inform how you interact with all of them. You know, I mean, there's also the concept of effort in practice. So we could say effort is tied into making goals, and it is. But can we then let go of the goals when we're not happy that we're reaching some idea? That's harder, I think, than sometimes making an effort. Mm. And Kaysan is pointing to don't waste your life. So don't make an effort to practice in some way that makes sense to you. And maybe then you do have to let that go a little bit. And also, I'll just say one more thing about that. The information you receive to yourself about letting it go happens, though, in relation to hearing about other people's practice. Do you know what I mean? Like, you might not know you're getting rigid until you hear other people holding the precepts, maybe like this a little bit. So if you were practicing in a vacuum, you might not even know that's happening to you. But my suggestion is just keep a wide berth and then also focus. Got to give you a paradox. Hi, Dennis.
Thank you for your talk. I was at a meeting this week, a group of people, and they were talking about hope. and I got very uncomfortable with the term. And thinking about it, one of the things I guess that made me uncomfortable about it was expectations. I hope to, or I hope for, and turning it into an expectation. And I came home and looked up the definition of hope. And it said, at least the one online was, the expectation or desire for something. And I was wondering if you could comment on that. I can take the desire part. Maybe that's part of what you were talking about relative to intention. But it's the expectation thing. My mind tends to go towards something specific, I guess. Could you just comment on that, you know, desire versus expectation?
Sure. Thank you, Dennis. Remember, the teaching was about the uncreated essence underlying all things. So oftentimes in Buddhist practice, well, and hope is a great word, but we might use aspiration instead. But hope and compassion and loving kindness, all these words help us create this particular reality that we're in. And there's a lot of teachings on how important words are in our practice. And I think because the words help us create this particular reality we're living in. So I don't want to completely let go of a word like hope, because there is so much negativity too. You know, we kind of see this being played out in our world today, of because it's so easy to get information and get people's opinions, like seeing kind of negative language battling out with positive language. But we know when we have hope, and let's say we have an intention of being out in the world and doing things because we have the hope of some idea of existence for ourselves, as we're doing that, our practice requires us to be present with the conditions that are happening in the moment and adjusting our expectations appropriately. It doesn't necessarily mean we give up hope, but we have to be realistic about what's happening in front of us. You know, I grapple with this a lot because I'm very much an idealist in general with human beings, obviously, because I don't think you could practice Buddhism if you weren't, but that's my opinion.
An idealist. But what do you mean by that?
That human beings are as sentient beings, that we're wonderful and amazing, and we are capable of amazing things. And we are capable of creating environments that are amazing. And I think we're going to do that. And I think we actually are doing that. But at the same time, the horrors that we could subject each other to are very real and not to be ignored. So even oftentimes in my own life, you know, I'm a teacher, so I'm constantly hopeful that people are going to grasp, understand, use what I'm teaching. And I'm constantly disappointed that from my perspective, they might not be. But I don't really know, because there's so many variables involved that I'm not privy to. So in a roundabout way, I'm trying to say, don't be discouraged by ideas of hope, and let people hope, because it is coming from a very good place. But adjust expectations moment by moment and respond accordingly moment by moment to that idea of hope. I don't know if that was helpful or not, Dennis. Okay, thank you. Well, it's probably time to do a time check.
It's 2 minutes after 11.
Yep.
So is there anything else anyone might like to add? How are we feeling in the room? Okay. We'll chant the three Bodhisattva vows, and I'm going to go up and do some prostrations. And then after that, we'll make some announcements. Okay. Beings are numberless. Let's try it again. Okay.
Beings are numberless. We bow to freedom. Delusions are inexhaustible. We bow to them. Dharma gates are boundless. We bow to them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. We bow to realize it.
Beings are numberless. We bow to freedom. Delusions are inexhaustible. We bow to cut through them. Dharma is boundless. We bow to them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. We bow to realize it. Beings are numberless. We bow to freedom.
Delusions are inexhaustible.
We bow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless. We bow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. We bow to realize it.